Well, here's a surprising statistics for you. About 40% of Wisconsin adults are expected to develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're going to be talking about diabetes today with a couple of guests. Dr. Dawn Davis, a UW health endocrinologist, associate professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She's also chief of endocrinology at the William S. Middleton VA Hospital in Madison. Dr. Dawn Davis, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
With us as well, Renee Walters. He is a clinical nutritionist, diabetes educator with UW Health. Renee, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, do you have questions about diabetes? We'll talk about what it does to your body and how you can prevent it with our two guests, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Dr. Davis, let's just start with you. How does diabetes occur in the body?
Well, there's two main types of diabetes that we talk about. We talk about type 1 diabetes. So type 1 diabetes was classically referred to as juvenile diabetes.
Yeah.
So that's diabetes that occurs when someone has an autoimmune disorder, where their body, essentially their immune system, starts attacking their own cells. And what it does is it attacks the cells in their body that make insulin. And so in those patients, they basically no longer can make any insulin on their own, and they have to take insulin every day. Type 1 diabetes does mainly occur in children and young adults, but it can happen at any age. So that's the smallest subset of diabetes. The vast majority of people with diabetes have what we call type 2 diabetes. And type 2 diabetes is associated with aging and with obesity. So as people get older and as people gain weight, they become more resistant to that hormone insulin, and their body can't use insulin effectively, and therefore their blood sugars start to go up. So insulin is the hormone that your body uses to help maintain a normal blood glucose or blood sugar level.
Yep.
And diabetes is essentially the disease where your blood sugars are too high.
Okay. You hear about pre-diabetes as well. What is, what's the difference?
Yeah, so pre-diabetes is a term that really defines people who are kind of in the early stages of type 2 diabetes. They haven't necessarily, their blood glucose levels have not gotten to the level where we would classify them as having diabetes, but they are already elevated above normal. And we know that people who have pre-diabetes have a very high chance of progressing to diabetes over the next few years. So we need to watch those patients very carefully.
And Renee, I assume that patients with the different kinds of diabetes require different types of, or maybe forms of education from people like you.
Absolutely. When it comes down to nutrition and diabetes education, it really is about carbs. With type 2, it's going to be a little bit about weight loss as well. But with type 1, so much of how they take insulin is based on how much carbohydrate they eat. So instruction in regards to proper nutrition is critical for both types.
Well, what does having too much glucose, having too much of it, what does that do to your health?
Right. So unfortunately, long-term exposure to high glucose levels can lead to all kinds of complications. And so people with high blood sugars over time in diabetes can have eye disease, where it's one of the actually the leading causes of blindness in this country is from diabetes-related eye disease. They can also develop kidney disease. It's the leading cause of kidney failure in this country. And it can also cause damage to the nerves, which can cause very painful nerve pain, often in the feet. And that can also lead to problems with amputations. In other words, patients have sores or injuries on their feet that don't heal, and therefore they can need amputations. So diabetes is also the leading cause of non-traumatic amputations in this country. So those are three of the big ones. But the other big thing is that people who have diabetes often are also at much higher risk of heart disease and stroke. So the thing that actually ends up killing most people who have diabetes is heart disease or stroke. Oh. So we're really working on not only managing their blood sugars, but also trying to prevent those complications of heart disease, stroke, eye disease, kidney disease, and everything else.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we can take some calls, perhaps. You can join in 800-642-1234. Sullivan in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. So one of my roommates happens to have hypoglycemia, and I just wanted to know what the difference was between hypoglycemia and diabetes.
Okay. Renee, do you want to take that? Or
no. This is one of Dr. Davis's.
Okay.
One of her many fortes.
Okay.
Sure. So hypoglycemia basically means a low blood sugar or low blood glucose level. And people who have diabetes can sometimes get hypoglycemia, often because of the medications they're taking that can kind of overshoot and cause them to have a low blood sugar. But people without diabetes occasionally do get hypoglycemia. There's a number of causes for it, but it's not specifically related to diabetes. It's usually related to either another medication or the body making too much insulin.
Okay. So there was that to help you out, Sullivan?
Kind of.
Kind of. What? How else can we help with that?
Like what sort of medications tend to cause hypoglycemia and what other types of situations can cause hypoglycemia?
So, I mean, any medicine that would normally be used to treat diabetes can, not any, but many of the medicines used to treat diabetes can cause hypoglycemia. there's a few other medications that can cause it. Some antibiotics can also be caused by alcohol use. And then the other disorders that we think about are problems with the liver function, kidney function, and adrenal function. And then we also look for tumors that might be producing too much insulin from the pancreas. So there's a really extensive workup that we do in patients who we think have hypoglycemia to try to understand what's causing it. But the number one thing really is to document that they're truly having low blood sugars and to try to capture labs at the exact time of that low blood sugar to help us figure it out.
How do you do that?
It can be tricky, but patients, you know, if they know what triggers them to have a low blood sugar, we ask them to, you know, kind of come in when they know they're likely to have a low blood sugar, or sometimes we can trigger one while they're sitting in the lab so we can capture the right tests at the right time.
You can actually trigger one?
Well, some of these people know what causes it. You know, sometimes they don't, they will have a low if they haven't eaten for a very long time, for example. So we have them come in when they're fasting and we check it that way. Or they know that certain foods trigger a low blood sugar, for example. So we kind of base it on each patient.
All right. Sullivan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Symptoms of diabetes? What are the symptoms?
The most common symptom is no symptom.
Yeah.
So it can be really under the radar, and there isn't necessarily, I mean, there are things that are glaring, but, I mean, you could say lethargy, you could say headaches, you could say just general malaise, just not feeling well. But the most common symptom is actually very asymptomatic or no symptom at all, and that's why this is such an insidious disease.
Yeah. And is it, let's say you go to, I go to my doctor once a couple times a year for checkups. Is that part of a normal checkup routine that you would be checking for something like this?
For many people, it should be. It depends a little bit on risk factors. So people who have a risk of diabetes, and then again, that comes with age, it comes with obesity, it comes with family history, then they should definitely be screened for diabetes every single year. The screening recommendations vary based on all of those factors. But yes, and it is a lab test, so it's not something you can figure out unless you do the appropriate lab testing with your doctor to find out.
Okay, there we go. Let's take another call. Mark in Three Lakes, we turn to you next. Hi, Mark.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a car accident, put a steering wheel through to my spinal column back in 77. They cut out two-fifths of my pancreas, did a Roux and Y after four surgeries, and I've been living with it quite naturally without any medications. Recently, I had a blockage in my heart. They put a stent in, and now they're trying to make my blood sugar become normal, which it never was. It hasn't been for 20-some-odd years. How do I cure this problem?
Huh. Interesting. What do you think, Dr. Davis?
So, yeah, that's a really brings up a few great points. So the first thing is that, as Mark mentioned, he had part of his pancreas removed. So your pancreas is an organ that sits in your abdomen. And inside your pancreas, only 1% of it is made up of these tiny little cells. And those little cells are called beta cells. And those are the cells that make insulin. So if you have to have your pancreas removed or part of your pancreas removed, you're losing some of those cells that are necessary to make insulin. So Mark was kind of starting out already at a disadvantage because he had lost some of those cells. And I guess probably over time then with aging, again, we tend to see that patients develop more significant hyperglycemia or high blood sugars or diabetes. He also mentioned that he recently had some issues with his heart, and that triggered all of this. And what we definitely know is that, again, heart disease is linked to diabetes. And when we see patients with heart disease, we're really pushing them to have the best possible control of their blood sugars as we can. So my guess is his doctors are really kind of tackling this more aggressively than they would have before he had this heart problem.
Okay. And so they would be giving him advice on...
So he may need insulin, or he may be able to be taking some medications that help him use insulin more effectively if he's still making some on his own.
All right. There we go. Mark, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Dr. Dawn Davis of UW Health. She's an endocrinologist, associate professor of medicine at the UW, and also chief of endocrinology at William S. Middleton VA Hospital in Madison. And with Renee Walters, he is a clinical nutritionist and diabetes educator with UW Health. We'll be taking a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back for them to answer more of your questions. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, about 30 million, a little bit more than 30 million people in the U.S. have diabetes, and about 1 in 4 with diabetes don't know they have it. We're talking about it today, that disease, with our two guests, Dr. Dawn Davis, UW Health endocrinologist, associate professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Renee Walters, a clinical nutritionist, diabetes educator with UW Health. Have you been successful in reversing diabetes? Many people have. What questions do you have about changing your diet? Be a part of the discussion. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I was taking a little, there was a little something that you probably use, a little test here. Are you at risk for type 2 diabetes? And there's an alert day from the American Diabetes Association, Renee. So a lot of it has to do with, well, age, if you're a man or a woman. Do you have a history of it in the family? Ever been diagnosed with high blood pressure? Are you physically active? What's your weight category? Those are the kinds of things that all go into play there, I guess.
I think one big one that's not in there as well is ethnicity plays a role as well.
Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, there's many different risk factors, but the one that we can't really change is going to be age. So
yeah.
Everybody's going to get older, and you lose beta cell function as you age, so it increases your risk.
Yeah, my points go up every 10 years or so. I can add another point against me on that. Well, let's take another call. Ken in Beloit, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. How are you, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that I had type 2 diabetes. My doctor looked at me and she said, your A1C is at 6.5. I think we need to start you on some metformin. And I said, I'll do that, but what can I do? Because, you know, I hate taking pills. She said, you need to lose weight. You need to exercise. You give up carbs and sugars. I did everything she said. The last time they checked it, it was 5.3. She said you no longer have to take the metformin anymore. So I'm happy, and I think that I check my blood sugars every day just to make sure, and I watch exactly what I eat and listen to my doctor because she's the greatest I have.
That's a wonderful story, isn't it, Dr. Davis?
Yeah, congratulations. That's outstanding. And, you know, that's exactly your perfect example of what can happen. You know, if diabetes is recognized early or even in that pre-diabetes stage, making diet and lifestyle changes can make a huge difference. In fact, you don't have to move mountains. You know, we say that losing as little as 10% of your body weight can actually reverse diabetes in that early time frame. So, you know, maybe you have to lose 10, 15 pounds, but it in the end, you know, you can definitely delay or hopefully prevent altogether that progression. So,
yeah, good on you, Ken. Thank you so much. You know, Nan in Madison has something that relates to this. Let's go to Nan. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, thank you. I think medicine does a wonderful job teaching the skill of eating and exercising, but is there a way that medicine can teach or support or help people with the will?
The will to change. Yeah, that's something that you deal with, Renee.
Yeah, I mean, so diabetes education is a profession that basically focuses on how can we facilitate behavior change, because it is not easy. And Dr. Davis touched on one of the main things that helps somebody control or even reverse type 2 diabetes, which is weight loss. And that's something that is not easy. It if it was easy to lose weight, we'd all look like supermodels, but we don't. So it's something that's challenging, and food is a very personal thing. As a dietitian, I talk about that a lot. So understanding how to manipulate your diet is hard to do, and without I think guidance and a trained professional that's going to point you in the right direction, it's hard to do it on your own. So you're verbalizing that the will to change is something that maybe has eluded maybe yourself or somebody else. I think it's a very tough question of why you'd want to change how you do things to impact your health. A good doctor sometimes can help you with that decision process. Obviously, a trained professional like a diabetes educator or a dietitian, even some, you know, nurses out there, they're very good at helping facilitate that behavior change. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, it's, I guess, and then as we get older, probably we're less likely to want to change what we do.
Right. Obviously we all get set in our ways as we get older, and it gets harder and harder to change. You know, it can be harder for people to exercise as they start to have more problems with their bones and their joints and, you know, that. But we try to really encourage people to, focus on, you know, one of the programs that we've had at our clinics is this idea of changing one thing. So instead of trying to get overwhelmed by all the different things that people are telling you to eat this, eat that, do this, do that, change your exercise, you know, focus on one thing that you can maybe change at a time. And that could be as little as getting up and going for a walk every day, or, you know, cutting out that dessert after dinner every day, you know, or only having it once a week instead of every day. Just small changes, and those gradually can build up into bigger change. But, you know, changing your whole life overnight is something that very few people can do. And the few who can should be applauded for it, because it's really hard.
I would add to that, something that I really encourage my patients to do is to try something new. And if it sticks for you, that's great. But if after 2-3 weeks, that behavior is not grabbing hold, move on to something else. It's, I use the example of, think of a Chinese buffet. The fun eating experience of a Chinese buffet is that you can pick little things from many different dishes. Exercise behavior change needs to be the same idea, where you don't, it's not about becoming a marathon runner or about sticking to one behavior change. You're only going to eat salads for lunch. It's about trying to find a variety of different things that motivate you. So that's definitely advice.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. And just changing one thing. You know, I can think of myself. I really didn't, you know, I started a little jogging regimen, and over 2.5 years or so, I dropped about 30 pounds, really. And I didn't change anything else. I just started burning, and that burns me about 500 calories in the morning or so. Well, in a week, if I do it 5 days out of the week, that's 2,500 calories. That's a lot of calories.
I think it's important to mention, Larry, though, that you have a secret weapon. And it may not be for everybody, but I like the idea of trying out different, especially fitness apps, because I'm on my phone all the time, and it's a very technical thing, but it has to be packaged in the right way. So just because somebody has a lot of success with a particular app, that doesn't mean that's the only one out there. You have to find one that really fits you. But when the right one fits you, it will motivate you to get out there and stick to that behavior.
Yeah, I use MapMyRun, and that's one that's worked well for me, and I like it a lot. Go ahead.
I was just going to add one other thing that can make it challenging, I think, is that, you know, diabetes, as we mentioned before, it's a disease that doesn't necessarily make you feel sick. So, the other thing is people don't necessarily see the consequences of what can happen with diabetes over time. So, you know, a lot of people might get a diagnosis of cancer and they'll make a lot of changes in their life and they'll really work hard to fight that cancer and to try to be cured. Well, diabetes can be just as deadly as cancer, but we don't have the same societal ideas around, you know, the urgency of trying to take care of that in the same way. So I think it's partly a societal thing too, that we just don't, you know, have the same concerns about diabetes that we do about some other diseases, and that makes it harder for people to be motivated to change.
Marie emailed to ask how consumption of alcohol, beer versus hard liquor, affects blood sugar levels.
Well, from a nutrition, I mean, I'm going to answer this just to begin with, but from a nutrition standpoint, it's going to be more about the total amount of carbohydrate. So it's volume and it's type. If you're having rum and Coke with regular Coca-Cola, that's going to be quite a bit of carb, and in a very, I don't want to get too technical, but a very high glycemic index package. So it's going to be basically straight sugar that's hitting your system. So the rum may be not as bad as the Coca-Cola in this one instance, but then volume and how much you're actually going to consume plays a big role in how high your blood sugars are going to elevate. You could almost make the same argument, though, if you're consuming a lot of beer. So it's about the carbohydrates. I think I'll let Dr. Davis expand on what alcohol actually does in terms of your beta cells. But in terms of total elevation, it's going to be more about the carbs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, an occasional one drink here and there is not something that we tell people with diabetes that they cannot do. But we do worry about people having multiple drinks at one setting, because number one, that can raise their blood sugar. But the other thing that can happen is it can mask their awareness of having a low blood sugar. And so people can have pretty severe low blood sugar sometimes in the setting of alcohol use.
I had a neighbor who was very fit. I grew up on a farm, and the neighboring farm, the farmer, had diabetes. Even though he looked to be in pretty good shape, he eventually lost both of his, had amputations on his feet. Died a very terrible death.
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, what we really try hard to avoid. And we're certainly doing a much better job now than we did even 10, 20 years ago at preventing those really bad outcomes and complications with amputations and blindness and kidney failure. But unfortunately, what continues to happen is the heart disease and stroke, and we haven't really made a lot of headway in preventing those deaths yet.
So there must be a genetic, I think there was a genetic component too on his family side.
Absolutely. So type 2 diabetes in particular is very strongly genetically associated. So patients, if you have one first degree relative, meaning a mom or dad or a sibling with type 2 diabetes, I think your chances of having type 2 is somewhere around 50%. And if you have two parents with type 2, you're talking about 80% or so.
80%.
So it's very high, very closely related to your family.
I would definitely add to that. It's not just about the genetic component itself, but behaviors. As children, you learn to eat from your parents. And when those templates are kind of set in place, that's how you're going to eat as an adult. So not to say that a traditional Midwestern diet is good or bad, but we have to look at how much activity has changed in the last 20 years. We're much more sedentary. We're more in front of a computer. And if our diets haven't adjusted to what our grandparents are eating, that's going to cause some health problems. And it may not involve diabetes. It may.
Karen in Milwaukee, thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, I've been listed as being pre-diabetic for probably 20 years, and my mother, who's 92, probably for 40 years. So it's never turned into diabetes in per se, but I'm wondering if there's still health effects, that can be happening to me and my mother. I mean, we do have heart disease in the family and stroke in the family, whether being pre-diabetic can cause some problems. And the other thing I wanted to mention, I was on metformin for a short time, and my sister-in-law, both of us had really severe reactions to it. I had heart palpitations from it that stopped when I stopped the drug. But for her, who had been taking it for a couple of years, she had severe asthma or lung problems that were finally figured out was from the metformin. So those are two concerns, or I just wanted to mention about the metformin, but the pre-diabetic thing I'm concerned about or wondering about.
Sure, Karen. Thanks for calling. Dr. Davis?
Sure. So I would say Karen's and her mom's situation is a little bit unusual in that typically when we categorize someone as having pre-diabetes, if we follow them over time and they don't make dramatic lifestyle changes, that we do typically see that progress to diabetes. So in their case, they may have, just a genetic predisposition, for example, to maybe slightly higher fasting blood sugars. We do sometimes see that, and it's not actually progressing. So the long-term consequences of that are probably pretty minimal because we kind of target people who have diabetes down to those levels to try to prevent those complications. So there's probably not a lot of long-term consequences. And then to follow up on the metformin comment, so metformin is the most commonly used drug for type 2 diabetes, and it's often used in pre-diabetes as well to help prevent progression. It is a really effective drug and generally pretty well tolerated. Those two side effects are actually not something that we commonly see with metformin. What we mainly see is people have abdominal side effects like bloating and diarrhea as the main thing. So I'm not 100% sure, exactly what was going on with those side effects, but typically it's very safe and well tolerated.
There we go. Karen, thank you. Let's go to Bob in Madison next. Bob, hello.
Yeah, thanks for my call. Great show. Just start off by saying I think they ought to call this diabetes because it really is a crappy disease to get. But I'm just kind of curious about, you're talking about carbs and intake and, being from the Midwest, you love your pastas, you love your rice with Chinese dinners, and, of course, having beer in Wisconsin. Just kind of curious about the ketosis diet, what your thoughts are on that, and if there are such things as good carbs and bad carbs, and what might be the difference between them.
Okay.
Well, there's a lot there. So first things first, a ketosis diet would be something where an individual would basically really limit their intake of carbohydrates so that they would force their body to burn an alternative fuel source, primarily fat. It's my take on it from a diabetes education standpoint, it's fairly inappropriate for somebody with type 1. And the reason I say that is because somebody with type 1 diabetes will need insulin for life. They need to replace insulin they're not making. Now, how much insulin they need, the factors are very complicated there. It's based on their activity. It's based on how much they're eating. It's based on many different factors. So a slight miscalculation that makes their blood sugar a little bit lower will warrant them taking in carbohydrates to raise their blood sugar back up. So if that person's trying to be in ketosis, the minute they treat that low with carbohydrates, they're They're going to throw themselves out of ketosis. So for type 1, it's very challenging to maintain that type of lifestyle. That's why it's not that it can't be maintained. It's just that it's very challenging. For an individual with type 2, it's a similar argument. You have to maintain that lifestyle for a very long time. And that's what you're basically saying, is that you're going to not eat carbs for the rest of your life. And I don't know, that doesn't really jive with most people. Some people are able to do it and they'll acclimate to not having carbs and they'll do fine without any carbs. But most of us after 3 or 4 years will want to have a slice of pie or a piece of bread or something of that nature. And that puts you in this position where you can't have it. And that's not necessarily healthy, I don't think, from a global eating standpoint. So that's the ketosis question. Your other question was, how does somebody in the Midwest kind of temper their carbs? I definitely think that just looking at your diet and maybe working with a nutrition professional to balance out maybe your carbohydrate a little bit better is something that is worthwhile for everybody. There is no magic number for amount of carbohydrates in a day. It really has to do with your activity. It has to do with what your goals are. So there's not any specific number that we try to shoot for. As far as some carbs being better than others, absolutely. Regular soda is probably the one thing that I'm going to say across the board is really challenging to fit into somebody's diet. You have to be a very active individual in order to warrant that type of nutrient, because it is just very dense. It's liquid sugar. Same thing goes with candy and concentrated sweets. Not to say that you can't have those things, but putting them around activity or decreasing your carbohydrate in your meal so you can fit in that carbohydrate for dessert, that's usually the soundest strategy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We have Ethan in Albany. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, I just had a question for your guests about sugar replacers like sucralose and aspartame and whether they affected blood sugar or induced the insulin response.
Good or bad for diabetes?
You take the insulin response.
Okay. I would say good and bad for the most part. They can be good because it's basically giving you that sweet taste to your foods without the carbohydrate load. So that can be a good thing. It helps you reduce calories, but can be bad in the for a few reasons. Number one, they can actually trigger certain changes in your body, including maybe some insulin response, but also changes in the brain, making you think you got food, but you didn't actually get food. And that can actually lead to more hunger and sometimes overeating. So I would say, you know, good and bad. If you're really struggling with weight loss, maybe avoiding them could be a good thing.
Same thing. I mean, so I think that they have a place. And when we talk about behavior change, I've had patients who are not willing to give up their soda, but they're at least willing to switch from regular to diet. And when somebody's consuming a 2 liter a day plus, that's a big decrease of carbohydrates that you're cutting out of their diet. I mean, we generally go by diabetes numbers with a test called an A1C, and I've seen somebody just switching from regular to diet drop their A1C by 3 points. So in that situation, it's pretty valuable, but it's not a cure-all, and it's definitely not something that you'd want to ingest a lot of.
And on that note, here we are quickly running out of time here. And for information on diabetes, I know diabetes.org is a great place to go. UW Hospitals has, at their website, has a lot of good information on all kinds of health issues, but diabetes certainly is in there. And on that note, we have to close. I hope you guys can come back and be with us again. Dr. Dawn Davis with the University of Wisconsin. She is a endocrinologist and associate professor of medicine. Renee Walters, clinical nutritionist and diabetes educator with UW Health. Great to have them along, and we'll talk about diabetes again. Thank you all for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.